Mark, it's been, what, I think 28 years since the murder of JonBenet Ramsey in Boulder, Colorado, or the outskirts of Boulder, Colorado. Still an unsolved case.
Looking back now, almost 30 years ago, when DNA was not at the, you know, state of speed and refinement that it is now, the question is, why do they keep it from the DA? Why do they keep this exculpatory evidence, you know, from the prosecutor?
He believes that when they were out, an intruder got in the house somehow and waited till they returned, waited till all the lights went out, waited till everyone was in bed, and then went and did the attack at that time. Retired Chief Mark Garrett, happy 2025, my man.
Happy 2025. Sounds like science fiction almost.
Yeah.
In the year 2525. Sorry.
Is that a Prince song? Is that a Prince song that I missed?
No. That's, what's the name of this? That's like from 50 years ago.
Really?
Yes. I can't sing, but anyway, it is.
Yeah, maybe you were more in the club scene than I was, Mark, 50 years ago. I don't know. Mark, it's been, 28 years since the murder of JonBenet Ramsey in Boulder, Colorado, or the outskirts of Boulder, Colorado. Still an unsolved case. Really one of the more notorious cases of the 90s, one of the more interesting cases of the 90s. And I realized in doing research on this case, I realized a lot of what I know was, quote, fake news. Fake news. It wasn't necessarily true, or it was, you know, partially true or tailored in a way to put pressure on people in the case. And that's why I wanted to talk about this case, because to me, it represents one of the first criminal cases, I think, and correct me if you feel differently, one of the first criminal cases of our time where law enforcement made the conscious decision to use the media to pressure suspects and try to get some type of cooperation from them. Or maybe it's better said, law enforcement used the media to drive public perception and use that public perception to pressure the two people who they thought were the main suspects or the only suspects in the murder. You know, back in, I think, June, July of 2024, Mark, you and I did a show about a relatively new investigative technique, and I'm going to kind of tease this for the end of the show. It's my opinion that this case could be solved in probably 60 to 120 days, that quickly, if law enforcement were to reanalyze some of the evidence and use this investigative technique. They may be doing that now. You know, obviously, they're not. It's an active case. They're not disclosing to the public what steps they're taking in this cold case, in this active investigation. But I am really confident, and we'll get into that a little bit at the end of the show. I am really confident that because of the evidence they have, if they were to reanalyze it and use this technique that we talked about 6 months ago, this case could be solved. You know, it didn't start as a murder, though, did it, Mark? It was December 26th, the day after Christmas, 1996. It starts with Patsy Ramsey, mother and wife, calling 911 and saying, my daughter has been kidnapped. My six-year-old daughter has been kidnapped. And I guess early in the morning, she comes downstairs. And by the way, Mark, the house is a big house, 6,500 square feet. Mm-hmm. Three stories. That actually plays into some of the things we're going to talk about here. I think the size of the house, mm-hmm. and maybe even more accurately, the architecture of the house.
Correct. The complexity, right? Of it.
The complexity of it. Yeah, good word. The complexity of the house plays into what happened here. But she calls 911 and says her daughter's been kidnapped and there was a ransom note. Mark, this police department, I think this... I don't know, you know, let's put it this way, not very experienced in homicide investigations, mm-hmm. or kidnapping investigations. Now, this is the day after Christmas, 1996. This was turned out to be, we haven't got there yet, but this turned out to be the first homicide of the year in that city. And, you know, we're almost through the whole year without without a homicide. You know, when you hear the beginning part of the story, right, it's before the body is found, and again, we'll get to that, but when you just hear there's a 911 call, a mom saying that her daughter's been kidnapped and they found a ransom note, which was kind of a strange note, admittedly.
Yeah.
What do you think about that now, having the experience of, you know, you and I talked to Gil Carrillo about the Night Stalker case in L.A., a guy who went into houses, who kidnapped children almost on the regular, or at least he did it frequently. He would go into a house, snatch a child, take that child out of the house and assault the child and then drop the child off somewhere. And that was 5-10 years before this case.
Yeah.
That initial information, Mark, what were your thoughts, you know, as a cop, as a now retired cop?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thought is, you know, when you're responding to a call like that, and again, I've never responded to a kidnapping call. Well, I take that back. I have, but on the freeway, on the highways, with actually in progress, when you're actually looking for a suspect vehicle, locate a suspect vehicle, things like that. But as far as a residence, I've never responded to a kidnapping case with the Highway Patrol. But it's like any other crime scene. You kind of want to start with the largest perimeter. In other words, practically speaking, in real terms, physically speaking, and in your mind, you want to think as large as possible and then go ahead and compress things as necessary. So that was kind of my first thought, you know, when I saw this and reading about the investigation, watching the documentary about where the detective's mindset or first responding detective's mindset might be. So when we look at it, again, I'm going to let you go ahead and lead this, you know, getting into what happened when they arrived, but there's certainly, again, 2020 is hindsight. I wasn't there in 1996, you know, so, but it just seems that there was not this objectivity in the mindset of police, law enforcement when they arrived in the scene. And I'm sure you're going to articulate that. Bill will talk about that. But in other words, you want to keep your mind open whenever you're dealing with a crime investigation. You want to look at the facts and you want to preserve as much physical evidence as possible and look from the outside in, you know, when you get to a crime scene.
Yeah, that's it. That's a really significant point that I think you just hit on here, because one thing that I know, and I don't know it from personal experience, just from hearing about this type of case with children, is the first thing you want to do is search the house. A lot, yeah. Sometimes a kid will disappear, go to a hiding place in the house or whatever. And police did search the house. And what did they find, Mark? They found nothing.
Yes. And by the way, I want to put that word search in quotes. And yeah. Again, I think we're going to get to this. And this is one of the points is that, again, I want to get ahead of the game here, but we're going to look at some of the things that they did that certainly compromised physical evidence, time frames, maybe DNA. But you're absolutely right. Children do go missing and often it's completely innocent. But you know, non-nefarious, but in this case, I think police missed those opportunities, actually did not engage in the type of protocol you would think that you would see from a larger agency with experience, in these types of crimes.
Right. Again, as I said, Mark, I don't have experience in kidnapping cases, but I have experience in searching houses, a lot of houses.
Yes.
And what should generally happen is, I get it, they do a quick cursory search. What do we have here? Is there anything that looks really out of the norm? Is the child here somewhere in the house? But then almost immediately when that's concluded, there's a secondary search that's done. And really the premise of the first search is there could be a suspect in the house.
Correct.
There could still be a suspect in the house at that time. Mm-hmm. So there should be a first relatively rapid cursory search, but then almost immediately after that, there's a secondary search where it's a lot more detailed. It's looking a lot closer at everything and really scouring every inch of that house.
And Bill, if I can chime in here, that it's a very good point that you make. And part of that search is, again, it can be extensive because some things can be very timely. Maybe a child is still alive in the house or anything like this. But you certainly want to do a preliminary interview of the residents of the home as quickly as you can. The reason is because you want to ask questions like this. Obviously, what time this happened? When did you discover the note? Have you looked in any other rooms? Have you noticed anything out of the ordinary? Which they ask some of those questions. But you want to do that as quickly as possible, get as much information as you can in a reasonable amount of time, because now when you go into the search that you're talking about, you can juxtapose any type of witness statements to what you find as an investigator. And this is where you can start narrowing down the facts. So, and it doesn't seem like that happened here. And again, I'm going to let you talk about those specifics, but these are the kind of sequential things that you do. You get the witness information, you get the information from the parents, and then you go ahead and conduct your own detailed search and, you know, weighing those two statements, physical evidence, observations together. Now you can start kind of narrowing down your investigation.
Yeah. Well said. One thing that I want to touch on at this point. So where are we is they think it's a kidnapping. They've done a week search of the house and they start looking at the ransom note that was found. There were a couple things about that the ransom note, which I still find interesting. The demand was for $118,000 in the ransom note, a strange amount, but it turned out to be the amount of John Ramsey's bonus at work, or very close to the exact amount of his bonus at work. I think that's significant. In law enforcement's eyes, they looked at it like he knew what that amount was. So they felt like it almost implicates him or the family in creating the note. I look at it as someone, one of two things, either someone going through their documents or papers in the house, or someone that knew him from outside, you know, which is something that really doesn't appear to have ever been investigated.
And I agree.
The second thing about the note, which I really haven't heard anybody speak of, but I think it's really strange. And I have a quote from it. The writer of the ransom note said they respected his business, but not who it served, which I thought was, you know, almost, you know, we have this thing going on with the CEO of United Healthcare being murdered, right? And when I see something like this, I'm like, man, was there some other motivation here? The company he ran was a computer services company, which was acquired by Lockheed Martin and later General Dynamics. So generally, you know, government contracting companies involved in the defense industry. I don't know if that's the correct, you know, a fair assessment of what his company did, if they were involved in that niche, but very strange language to me in a ransom note to talk about kind of an ideological thing. Like he doesn't, the kidnapper or whoever wrote the note, not a fan of the, you know, who this particular business served. Anything else about that ransom note, well, Mark, that you thought was weird?
It's a great point, Bill. And in other words, when you look at something that specific, that personal to one of the parents here, an odd ransom dollar amount that mirrors his bonus, people say, well, it had to be him or it had to be the wife because who else would have known? Well, to me, just like you said, to me, this indicates it's someone outside, because we can say a lot of things about the Ramses, I guess, if you want to, but there's nothing here to indicate that they're that stupid. Mm-hmm. But they would actually put a number that matches his bonus in the ransom. In other words, that would be a dead giveaway, theoretically. Mm-hmm. The second part about this is the length and detail and kind of rambling to some point, to some extent, of the ransom note. This is not your typical, if there is, it's not your typical ransom note. Ransom notes are usually a lot more succinct. They're specific. They're cut and dry. There's not a lot of editorializing about the victim, the kidnapped victim, the people who may pay the ransom. is straightforward. I mean, we can juxtapose this to, say, maybe the ransom note with the Patty Hearst. We talked about that some episodes ago as well. So there were some ideological things in there, but it was pretty specific. Do this, don't do this, or she dies. This one was more like, you know, it was gone with the wind in length. And so that's more like, well, this is something that was something written from the inside, you know, from the wife, from the husband, things like this. But outside of that, and I think also with the ransom note, it was determined by a handwriting expert that it wasn't, you know, Patsy Ramsey who wrote the note, if I remember correctly. So was it unusual in a lot of ways? Yes. Do I think it was probably a true ransom note from someone outside? Just to kind of cut the chase here, probably.
Yeah. And I think to kind of highlight what you're saying there, the FBI made kind of a similar assessment that you did of the note. They said they didn't think it was legitimate because of the odd amount of the request, $118,000, and also because of exactly like you said, the length of the note. They just said it wasn't what they would normally see in a kidnapping. But one thing I always caution, Mark, is just because something doesn't seem usual doesn't mean it's not possible. And too often there is the, you know, the push towards making everything fit in, you know, a nice square peg and a nice square hole, and not always possible. Like, not every crime fits this general category or looks exactly the same. There's going to be a lot of differences, and as much as there are normal things you expect to see, there's going to be these crazy situations that you can't ignore, or you can't assume they're not true just because of how it happened. Like what we talked about in American Nightmare, where this guy calls the police and says, you know, multiple people in wetsuits came in his house and kidnapped his girlfriend and had lasers on their guns. Turns out to be really pretty much, you know, what happened, although there was some deception going on. Turns out to be what happened, and the police just discounted it because it seemed so crazy. So the next thing that kind of happens, and again, this is still when it's a kidnapping, still early in the morning on the 26th, the police ask for some writing exemplars of John and Patsy Ramsey, some papers in the head. What do they have with their handwriting on it so they can look at, make a comparison between that and the ransom notes? So both parents, John and Patsy, supply each a different like notepad, notebook that has some of their writing on it. And there was a guy named Jeff Kitcart, I think Boulder PD, who kind of took this. He was a fraud investigator, kind of took it to examine it. And in the notebook of Patsy Ramsey, he sees what he thinks is the start of what they call a draft ransom note. And I think it said something like, I don't know. It was like, Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, or Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, Mr. And Mrs. And it just had a single stroke of a pen. So it could have been an R. It could have been the start of the letter R, or really a bunch of different letters. But the cops looked at that as this was a practice letter, or this was an initial ransom note that Patsy created in her notebook. United States Secret Service, though, Mark, like you noted, they looked at the handwriting later and said, no, neither person wrote this letter.
Neither parent,
right? Wrote the ransom note. And even with these kind of, I don't know if you'd call them exculpatory, or even with these puzzle pieces that didn't match this narrative that the local police department was trying to put together, or it didn't match the theory that they were forming of what happened in this kidnapping, they kind of push forward with that anyway. So at this point in time, they're expecting a phone call from the kidnapper, but I think the note said something like between 8 and 10 a.m. They don't get the call, and John Ramsey starts getting very anxious. He feels like, and I assume, Mark, this is a pretty common feeling from a parent victim like this. They want to know what's being done, how come nothing is being done, et cetera, et cetera. And a police officer or detective in the house tells him, hey, go take a look around, see if anything stands out as being unusual to you. And that's what he does. And it seems like, Mark, he starts in the basement. That turns out to be, you know, the police have one view of that, but it seems like he decides to start in the basement. He sees a basement window that's broken and open. Now he knows, or he says that he had broken into the house through that same window back in the summer, like 6-8 months earlier. He had locked him, or 5-6 months earlier, he had locked himself out. No one was home. And he says that he actually got into the house through that basement window. So he sees a window open, the glass is broken, kind of potentially indicating that someone had broken the glass from the outside, reached in, unlocked the window, opened the window, entered the house. And he continues to look around the basement, and that's where he finds JonBenet's body, in a different room in the basement. And again, this is where kind of the initial cursory search of the house really failed the investigation, because what does he do? It's his daughter that he just found. He picks her up. She had tape on her mouth. He rips the tape off, and he brings the body upstairs in the house. You know, so Mark, you talked about maintaining the crime scene. And also another thing that's really significant at this point, which I heard justification for, which makes no sense, and I want to hear your thoughts on it. They allowed the family to invite friends and family members over to the house. So now we have people from outside coming in the house, and the police justification for that is they said, whoa, we didn't know it was a murder scene at that time. We thought it was a kidnapping. Why does that make even one bit of difference? That house is a crime scene. There's been really no forensic search or no forensic analysis done of the house, and you're inviting other people into the crime scene. So it's contaminated right there. So Those two things, the movement of the deceased body, JonBenet, the movement of her, the removal of the tape from her mouth, and the inviting of other guests over to the house, is that something that should have happened? And is something like, is it fair for me to say that that's detrimental to the investigation going forward, that those two issues?
Yeah, I think it's pretty elementary, Bill. Those things shouldn't have happened. One of the things we saw in the documentary and later, in regards to this, you know, cloud of suspicion around the Ramseys about this, one of the things that law enforcement, this one detective talked about, was when they asked the Ramseys, or asked John Ramsey, to, hey, go walk around the house again and see if there's anything unusual, things like this, which was a huge mistake, obviously. But they said, well, he went to the basement first. How odd is that? Well, I don't know if it's odd or not. First of all, we know that the Ramseys had walked the house previously. So think about this from your point of, you know, from your point of view, listeners. If you're in a situation, God forbid, and you walk through the house looking for your child, looking for anything out of the ordinary, would you most likely go back to those same places a second time, you know, on the advice request of law enforcement? Or would you say, oh, you know what, I haven't looked in the basement yet, let me go look down there? To me, it's a logical thing to do. Now, again, I don't know where John Ramsey walked the house the first time, but it's likely that he hadn't been in the basement, so he walked down there seeing if he might find something that he, you know, he missed before, because he had entered the basement. Plus, they call it the train room. They kept their model trains down there, other toys. It was a place that the kids would frequent, apparently, and I'm sure he felt that he had missed this on his first walk through the house. That's number one. Number two, to your point about the friends coming over, Bill, He said it doesn't matter if this is a kidnapping crime scene, a murder crime scene. It's a crime scene. So why would you let anybody into the house that's not already there upon your arrival? It's crazy. You can contaminate things with evidence, so you can move evidence around. By the way, you can influence the statements, the recollection of the parents in the house with multiple friends. The other thing to consider is this, that again, murders were almost always committed. Now, again, they didn't know it was a murder scene at the time, a crime scene, but murders and other types of intimate crimes like this, kidnapping are often committed by someone that you what? Know. So why would you now go invite the closest people, the family, the friends, their neighborhoods? In other words, you are really throwing fuel on the fire as far as the integrity of your crime scene, because you're bringing in not just anybody, you're bringing in people who are physically and maybe intimately as close to the Ramseys as possible. So it's the most ridiculous, most elementary violation of crime scene integrity that I can think of at this point.
Yeah. And let's talk about the cause of death. So there was evidence of asphyxiation by using a garrote. Mark, are you able to explain what exactly that is, like technically how that's made with?
Yeah, you know what, just from my research over the years, but it's really, you know, it's really a torture device. Mm. When you think about it, obviously, you know, ultimately, ending in death, but it's something that it's a rope with a device with something you can twist, gives you leverage to turn a ligature, whether it's a rope or it's an electrical cord, whatever it is, but it's something that you can twist to make something tighter or looser around whatever it is, an arm, a neck. It's really similar to a tourniquet. When you think about that, people may be more familiar with a tourniquet, where you can put something around a limb, and through that you can put, you know, a limb, a pencil, a rod, and you can turn that down tighter to stop the flow of blood, to prevent blood loss. So it's the same thing here, where it can prevent blood flow and airflow, and that's what it is. So it's really, in this sense, when it comes to criminal use, it's a terrible device, and it's a torturous device if you want to use it that way.
Interesting. So you could use it to cut off the blood supply to the brain, cause the victim to pass out, but then if you release the tension, the blood would flow again, come back to consciousness. So I see what you're saying by calling it like a torture device or almost like a manipulative device. So there was definitely evidence of that. The coroner said strangulation and also cranial trauma. There was a very large skull fracture. And I think if I'm correct, the coroner could not say, I think the phrasing was something like they happened in a very close temporal proximity. He couldn't say which happened first, but it was, those are the things that killed JonBenet. Now the garrote was made with a paintbrush. What would you call it? An artisan paintbrush? Like, yeah, not a house painting brush, but a correct artistic paintbrush, right? The handle, yeah, of it.
Yep.
Was broken off, used to kind of twist around the cord, exactly like you said it would be, to tighten, loosen. And the other half of the paintbrush was apparently used to sexually molest JonBenet, or sexually assault is probably a better word, JonBenet.
Yeah.
Yes. So obviously evidence of not just a murder, not just torture or manipulative murder, but also sexual assault. It was about this time that I think that one of the quotes that I saw was, you know, word back at the police department about this time was, and is a quote I got from the documentary, "I knew it, they killed their kid." So really immediately the police apparently started forming the opinion that this was, family murder, that the parents did it. Did you see the interview of the female police officer or detective who was one of the first responders there? Do you recall that? Go ahead, Mark.
No, refresh my memory.
Yeah, so what struck me about it, Mark, is she said she was wearing a shoulder holster. I don't know if this will bring it back. And she said that she almost, when she was talking with John Ramsey, she almost put her hand on her gun because she said she didn't know if she was going to make it out of the house alive.
Yeah, like I remember fear. Now. She looked in his eyes and saw, yes.
Yeah, the eyes were just,
yes.
I mean, she looked a little suspect to me, yeah. Right?
Yeah. By the way, everybody watching, you see what happens when you get to my age? You have to have a little help in your memory sometimes, but yeah, no, you did a good job of there, back.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
And again, these are people that, or I shouldn't say these are people. She is someone who left the police department for whatever reason, and then immediately went and started doing interviews about this case. And to say that you were in fear of your life and you didn't, I know it was almost something like, I didn't know if I was going to make it out of there alive.
Correct.
When I saw the look in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have had this discussion before is whenever people have an opinion of how someone should act in a situation, it bothers me because I just think there's such individuality and everyone's different. Everyone deals with trauma differently based on their life experiences. It's very hard to say, well, the person didn't react like the parent of a murdered child should react. I mean, what should that reaction be? And I get it. You know, someone might say anger, rage, sadness, or whatever. But really, I don't think that's fair to use that as evidence that someone committed a crime.
Yeah, Bill. The thing is, when you say, especially as a law enforcement professional, this is, I think it's what we're talking about here. It's completely inappropriate. Completely inappropriate. Now, when we're talking about markers, indicators, that can be different. If you can articulate specific things that are highly unusual, maybe consistent with, leading towards a sense of responsibility or guilt, in other words, deceit. When you get consistent, inconsistent statements, you know, over and over and over, someone is elusive in answer, someone is deceitful based on hard facts that you know to be true.
Mm.
That's different than this feeling that I have. Well, this person looked crazy. I was afraid for my safety. These don't have any basis in fact and in evidence. It's just a feeling that you have. That's a bizarre thing to say. And maybe it's a good thing that she left law enforcement.
Yeah, I agree with you on that subject. Let's talk a little bit about the DNA evidence, because that turns out to be key. And like I said, I mean, when we get to the end of this, we'll talk about how this case probably should be solved. But there was DNA evidence under the fingernails of JonBenet. They recovered DNA, a foreign DNA, let's say, not hers. And also in her underwear, they recovered DNA. They knew relatively quickly, I think within about 3 weeks, that this DNA excluded the family members. So, Mark, how do you feel about them? Now, the allegation is, I shouldn't maybe even use that word, it seems like they kept this information from the district attorney initially, and they kind of continued with the narrative that, or their own theory that the family was involved. At what point do you need to look at the science or look at the DNA and let go of that and move on? Did it seem strange to you the way that DNA evidence was handled, and how that had very little impact initially on the direction they went with the case?
Well, yeah, you know, Bill, and here's where I want to be. I certainly have my opinions about it and why they did what they did. However, looking back now, almost 30 years ago, when DNA was not at the state of speed and refinement that it is now, the question is, why do they keep it from the DA? Why do they keep this exculpatory evidence, from the prosecutor? I have my reasons, and I'll say it right up front, that I think that because the investigators, or at least one of them for sure, were biased. That's my belief. But there could be in a broader sense, objective sense here, it could have been hey, we want to get even more exculpatory evidence, or we want to get all the evidence we can before we kind of present this to the DA, before it goes to the public so everybody can get a big picture, things like this. I don't think that was the case, but is it a possibility? Yes. I think that they didn't give it to the DA because I think that, again, the investigation, at least to some degree, was biased. And they were hoping that there might be other DNA, there might be something else that ties the parents to the case, and make this, you know, really an easy investigation for them. That's my belief. Are there other possibilities? Of course there are, but that's where I think this was going, you know, 28 years ago.
Yeah, and I know the, at least in the documentary you watched, and again, Mark, I always have this caveat where you're seeing it from one point of view. Mm-hmm. And even Vince, our producer, before we started, said he felt like John Ramsey might have financed the documentary because it was the story was almost told through his eyes, you know, but he has the right to tell his story. You know what I mean? So that's right. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Let's talk a little bit about the media and the role the media played at this point in the case. You know, one thing that shocked me was, and by the way, the homicide investigator or the investigator who was assigned to the case at this point, Mark, didn't have any homicide experience, at least according to the documentary. Didn't have any homicide experience. He was a narcotics detective. And, you know, I mean, hey, we talked to Gil Carrillo about the Night Stalker case. And again, you see the hundreds of cases that he has, and you wonder how a case like this would have played with him if he was the lead investigator there on scene right away. But back to the media, there was a lot of information in the media that was almost, I don't know, orchestrated or driven to make the parents look guilty of the crime. And some of it had to do with what I would guess I would call a sexualization of, you know, this six-year-old victim. There was the Geraldo Rivera show, and they actually had a mock trial on the show where they supposedly put on evidence. And the one thing that struck me from that, Mark, is they showed a video, and I'm going to try to be careful how I say that this because it's not algorithmically friendly, right? But yeah, they showed a video of JonBenet playing the saxophone. Nothing about that video struck me as being unusual, right? It was like a talent show, and everybody knows she was involved in pageants and talent shows, and she's playing the saxophone. And I think, as I've seen many people play the saxophone, bending over at the waist and, you know, either pretending to play the saxophone. It's not even clear to me if she was actually playing it, Mark, or if it was just like a prop. Looking like she's playing the saxophone. They had an expert on the Geraldo show saying that that was masturbation, that her handling of the saxophone was masturbation, and it shows that she was sexually active. I thought that was one of the most ridiculous statements about this whole case. Did you catch that part of it?
Bill, I simply could not agree with you more. And by the way, that's the first time I remember seeing that Geraldo episode. I didn't even remember the mock trial. I probably tried to forget it because it was so ridiculous. So there are two things that, you know, two things can be true at the same time. I do remember, obviously, when this happened, and I remember there was a lot of outcry from, you know, a lot of different arenas about the sexualization, or the claimed sexualization of these very, very young girls, these pageants being made up with, you know, adult makeup and the wigs or the hairdos and things like this, and how they were dressed, and some were dressed. I even back then I thought, you know, that's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And I still feel that way. I still feel that, you know, let kids be kids, and it's, you know, sometimes things like this are just too much. Having said that, Bill, I feel the same way about that saxophone claim. I'm looking at this. I said, well, I've been watching people for all my life play a saxophone, and they're playing to the rhythm of music, and they're swaying back and forth and things like this. I didn't see that at all. And for them to call that, you know, masturbation or mimicking it, I just thought that was absolutely ridiculous. I'm really glad, you know, because I respect you so much, Bill, your opinion. And when I was looking, it's like, geez, I wonder what Bill thinks about this, because I think this is an absolutely ridiculous claim. I could not agree with you more.
Yeah, and it seems like the media, I don't know if it was almost a concerted effort, who knows, but it also, as I mentioned earlier, I do feel like the police selectively released information, and the goal of that was to, and now in a deposition, the lead investigator even, it sounded like he kind of put it on the FBI. He said like, yeah, I do remember, or there were discussions that we had with the FBI about putting pressure on John and Patsy Ramsey. And I think what they hoped to do was kind of create a split where one of them would, quote, testify against the other, and they'd get the full story about what happened, because they felt that one of them was guilty, right? Mm-hmm. The police released information that really, like, one of the things, Mark, which I at the time thought was major evidence, they said there was no footprints in the snow outside the house. And they said, hey, there's no footprints in the snow. And then everybody ran with that. There's no footprints in the snow. It had to be someone inside the house. And then to look at newsreel footage from that day, there's barely a dusting of snow in the front yard. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, in the backyard, there was no snow. And I don't know, maybe exposure, you know, different exposure to sunlight, et cetera. So really, that was completely irrelevant. That was one thing. They didn't talk about, they didn't release information that there was no DNA match to the family. Now, I don't expect them to really, I don't expect them to release that. But if you're going to release other things that are right, tending to implicate the family, and if you're doing that on purpose to exert pressure on them to try to get one of them to, quote, crack, it just doesn't seem ethical in a sense. The police didn't release that, you know, the Secret Service handwriting expert said there was not a match of family members to the ransom note. So there was a lot of things, and even creating the perception that there was sexual abuse going on in the home. And the evidence of that was, I think at one point they talked about John Ramsey, the father, having pictures of his child on his desk. And I don't know if it was at work or in an office at home. And it was pageant pictures. And they said, oh, these pictures were inappropriate. There must be some sexual abuse going on. And everything in the case, almost not, there were many things in the case that to me sounded like big jumps with no really or really minimal circumstantial facts to back up these big jumps or potentially implicating facts that they just made these big jumps.
Yeah, and this is why I said earlier, okay, I'll try to, you know, remain objective here. And, you know, why did they do X, Y, Z specifically with the DNA, not releasing that information? But I made it clear. But I think that the reason was because that this investigation was certainly tilted in the hopes of legally implicating the Ramseys, one or both of them. The thing about the snow, Bill, and I recall that too, it's one of those things from 1996 that I remember as well from the media. It's like, oh my God, there are no footprints in the snow. I mean, there's snow there and it's pristine going up to that basement window. You know, how did someone get in? Did they float in like a ghost? It had to be an inside job.
Yep.
I thought the same thing. It shows you how easily anybody can be manipulated if you're only getting certain, I won't even say facts because it wasn't a fact, but getting certain claims or certain statements from whether it's the media or law enforcement, things like this. In other words, we only know what we're told. And if you take it to be factual, then you have to jump to a certain logical conclusion. If there's no evidence that anyone walked in from the basement, then where does that leave you? Mm-hmm. It leaves you to believe that it had to be an inside job. But I'll say this, Bill, you said earlier, I forget the word you used, and pardon me if I misquote, but that, you know, that statement wasn't accurate or something like that about the snow. It was more than that. It was a lie. It was an absolute outright lie through exclusion, because what they didn't tell you is, well, there were no footprints in the snow, but there wasn't any snow to step in. See, that's a lie by exclusion. You're excluding another fact. So this was really, really terribly deceitful. By the way, if it turns out that you know, there's other evidence that would have implicated, real evidence that would implicate the Ramses one or both, statements like that would put a huge, huge torpedo-sized hole in the prosecution because it would show that there's bias in the investigation.
Yeah. And by the way, with the sexual abuse allegations, the family doctor or JonBenet's doctor, pediatrician, came out and said pretty strong language, patently false. Said I saw no evidence of this whatsoever. I am obligated to report such evidence if I see it during an examination or whatever. And it was very, very clear that he said he saw no evidence of it. So just to mention that.
And by the way, that wasn't, just so everybody knows, that was not an autopsy. That was in there. You know, that was historically, in other words, that doctor's talking about all the time that she was my patient.
Yep.
I never saw any indication of that whatsoever.
Yep. So about this time, and you know, I don't know, Mark, I don't know really the details of it, but what's described as a rift starts to form between the investigators on the case and the district attorney's office. Again, I won't speculate on it, but the district attorney decides to go outside, which is a little unusual, I think, and hire a investigator from the outside to come in and take a look at the evidence. And his name is Lou Smith. And Lou apparently was a very highly respected law enforcement officer with a lot of homicide experience, a skilled homicide investigator. He comes in and looks at the evidence, and there are some really interesting things that he found when he looked at the evidence. And just to highlight a couple of them, Mark, and let me know if there's any other ones or what you thought of him in general. He looked at the bed, and he said that he could tell that someone was dragged off the bed. And he also saw, he said, no evidence that the bed was wet. We'll get into that a little bit later, but I'll mention that now. Examining photographs of the body, he found what he said were, they called it an air taser, but stun gun is really what it appeared, right?
Yeah.
Little kind of circular or square or little rectangular.
Rectangular.
Node imprints on the body in two separate places. One behind the ear or on the neck behind the ear, and a second on the back. There was no identification of that by anyone else. And, you know, there were pictures of them. You could see them. Yes, that's what it appeared to be. And he even went out and looked at some different devices and felt that he identified a little bit more specifically what type of device it was. He went to photographs of the basement. And though this is another key thing, Mark, they said the police released that there was no sign of a forced entry to the house.
Right.
Now, Lou Smith looks at pictures of the basement, and there's a window open, the glass is broken, and there's a piece of glass on top of a suitcase that's below the window, and even a bit of what he calls a footprint on the suitcase. So it appears that a suitcase was put by this window to, you know, on end, I guess is how you would describe it, or standing up, not flat, to use as a step stool to get out the window, a piece of broken glass on it and a footprint on it. What else? Oh, one other thing that I recall, which I thought was really interesting, was above this. Now, this is a basement window we're talking about. Above this basement window is a grate. So this grate would have to be removed, and you'd kind of step down in a cement well and go into the window. Now, the local police felt that no one could get in and out of the house that way. John Ramsey said he had done it the previous summer, and then Lou Smith, this investigator, actually did it. he actually did it to show it could be done. And it didn't look like a struggle either. He had it video recorded. It looks like he did it relatively easily.
He did. It looked like completely no stress.
One interesting thing there is he, and I thought, man, this is genius for this guy to even pick up on this. He looked at the grate and he said it was laying on top of some foliage. And it's going to be hard for me to describe exactly, but picture long grass, you know, growing over on the edge of a grate, long grass growing over that edge of a grate. You pick the grate up, and when you put it back down, the grate is now on top of that long grass, and it's kind of folded it over, and it's matted down underneath it. He saw that and said this grate had to have been removed recently because there's this foliage or grass underneath it now that would not have grown this way. It would only get there by someone removing the grate, putting the grate back down on top, and matting that foliage down underneath it. What did you think of his analysis when you heard some of the things that he identified in the case, or that he felt were not that were overlooked or we didn't know about in any case?
He sounded, to put it simply, he sounded like a seasoned, thorough, and objective investigator. I can't put it any clearer than that, Bill. You know, one of the things, you're talking about the alleged, I'll say, taser marks on her body. You know, they went back and used a pig carcass because the pig skin is very similar to a human, and to replicate the marks with the device that he identified as making them on her body. So he was very thorough with this, and you would think that. And I don't know from documentary. I couldn't find anything about this in reading up on the case. I'm assuming, like any other good homicide investigator, that somebody was there present during the autopsy. I mean, that is standard procedure for an investigator, when possible, to be there to witness the autopsy, make his or her own notes along with the physician, the doctor, medical examiner, doing that. And, you know, how these marks, this is a huge deal, how these marks, by the way, whatever they were, how they were overlooked and not noted in the investigation is really kind of, you know, beyond me. The grate, the metal grate to the basement, I think is another extraordinarily important piece of evidence that was overlooked by the investigators, by the Boulder PD investigators. This, in other words, if there is an ingress to this basement where John Ramsey finds a body, it just seems like so much of your energy would go to that location. Okay, could anybody get in and out of here easily? Is it possible? It seems very elementary. The fact the DA went outside to get this really now private investigator, but has all this homicide investigation experience, this is something that, you know, occurred to me early on as far as Boulder PD's experience. We talk about small agencies and their, you know, their experience or lack of in these types of major investigations. It's not unusual for some fairly large, I mean, small, large agencies that I'm familiar with in Southern California, when they have certain cases, they will go to, talking about Los Angeles County specifically, mm-hmm. they'll reach out to Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, maybe LAPD, or maybe the California Highway Patrol, depending on the type of incident they're dealing with. Say, hey, can you come in and either take over this investigation or let us still be the lead investigator, but can you assist us with the investigation? That's normal procedure. It happens all the time, all the time. And why Boulder PD would not have done the same thing that the DA decided to eventually do, reach out to the sheriff's department, the state police for assistance in something like this, again, is beyond me.
And I think they're driving the narrative, the police department's effort to drive the narrative that we talked about. It did have an effect because I think there was a survey done at the time and 70% of the local population of Boulder thought the parents were involved in the murder. 70%. Here's a couple other things that Lou Smith found. And again, a very well-respected detective. And what's interesting is when he started kind of showing these this alternative theory to what the police had, they began to discredit him and called him, one thing was like a doddering investigator or someone looking to make a name for himself by solving this case. I don't know. It looked like common sense, good investigative work to me. The lead investigator in the case had a theory of the crime. His theory was that there was a, quote, toileting, unquote, issue. So the theory would be that JonBenet wet the bed and that in a fit of rage, Patsy Ramsey killed JonBenet Ramsey. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. And I mentioned earlier, Lou Schmidt looked at the photographs and said there was no evidence of a wet bed. He could also tell that the sheets, or he also believed that the sheets had not been changed because there was other forensic material, let's say hairs or fibers in the sheets that likely would not have been present if the sheets were washed and fresh sheets were put on the bed before the crime scene analysis was done. Another thing was, in the guest bedroom next to JonBenet's room, there was a length of rope, and the Ramseys could not, didn't know what it was. I don't know what that is. I don't know why it's in our house. And Lou Schmidt theorized that that rope was potentially brought in by the killer and left there accidentally or whatever in the room next door. Another thing that he found, and you and I talked about this in the American Nightmare case in, what was that, Visalia? Is that, no, not Visalia.
It was Northern Vallejo. California. Vallejo. Thank you. Yeah. Uh-huh.
There was a similar sex assault in Boulder, and it was, you know, it was a 14-year-old, so not as young as JonBenet, but it was a situation where someone had gotten in the house earlier in an evening and kind of hid out, waited till after dark, after everyone went to sleep, then attempted an attack. In that case, the mom woke up, used, I think, pepper spray to chase the intruder out. But a similar MO, because John Ramsey's theory was that him and his wife, Patsy, went out to dinner the night of the 26th. He believes that, and the kids were at home, he believes that when they were out, an intruder got in the house somehow and waited till they returned, waited till all the lights went out, waited till everyone was in bed, and then went and did the attack at that time. So that would be similar to this MO in the other case. And interestingly, Mark, that 14-year-old victim went to the same dance studio as JonBenet did. And, you know, we don't know, again, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know how much some of these theories were looked into, but it reminded me of the Vallejo case in that there was similar crimes. And what did it take in the Vallejo case, American Nightmare? It took a detective from a neighboring town to actually dig into it and look at this MO and see who, if there was a suspect in that or whatever, and put the pieces together. And, you know, I don't really know that that was, again, we don't know if that was done in this case, but if not, it's something that should have been done when you have an MO that's somewhat similar like that. So next thing, Mark, is another expert comes in. This guy is a grand jury expert. And this is actually something that's been done even right here in LA County. I saw a story recently that Gascon brought in an outside expert to review police shootings and recommend charges in police shootings over the past several years that hadn't been charged first time around. So they present all this evidence to a grand jury. There's some contention that they apparently, Lou Schmidt claims, this outside investigator that was brought in, he claims they tried to keep him from testifying at the grand jury. He eventually does get to testify there. I could not really figure out how that happened, Mark. I heard something about a lawsuit, or he somehow got, it somehow sounded like he had to go through some legal process to be able to get into that grand jury and present this information that he found. And what happens is really strange, right? Because they brought in this grand jury expert. They present all to decide if the evidence should go to a grand jury. If I'm recalling right, he decides, this expert decides, we're not going to present this to a grand jury. And the lead investigator of the case resigns in protest. Mm-hmm. And writes, I guess, a scathing letter or something. And somehow the pressure is put on the office and they decide to let the case go to grand jury anyway. They're going to present the evidence to a grand jury. If I get this off, Mark, if you think it happened a different way, let me know. They present all the evidence to the grand jury. And at the end of that, they hold a press conference and they're very careful about what they say. They say that no charges are going to be filed at this time. So, you know, what I would think if I heard that is, with my experience, I would think, oh, there was a no bill. In other words, the grand jury didn't find sufficient evidence, didn't find probable cause that the parents were involved in the murder. So there weren't going to be any charges filed. It came out a number of years later, I think 2013 or something like that. It came out that the grand jury actually did recommend or did indict for, felt the parents should be charged with something. Mm-hmm. And I think it was something along the lines of child abuse resulting in death.
Yes. But, child endangerment and child abuse.
Okay.
Yes.
And the DA, chose not to file the charges because, you know, I guess he has the ethical obligation. I know he has the ethical obligation not to bring a charge where he feels the evidence doesn't support it. And, he is the one that made the determination, even though the grand jury said to indict. And at that time, I did hear the statement made in the stuff I watched. You could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Yep. At that time, maybe today, no. Like, you know, people are a lot more involved in the criminal justice system in our country now. It's a lot more questions come up in grand jury, et cetera, et cetera. But even though the grand jury felt there was some criminal culpability, the DA chose not to file charges after all that. Where do you land on that? Like that whole thing that went down with bringing in the grand jury expert, et cetera.
Well, I'll be honest about the grand jury and, you know, bringing in the expert. I'm with you. I'm glad you're asking me to, you know, say, clarify if you're making a mistake, because it was a kind of, that whole thing was cloudy to me as well. That whole sequence of events, it was very murky about what was going on. But I'll cut to the chase of the grand jury and their recommendation to file these charges. To me, Bill, I think that the grand jury was as susceptible to public pressure as anybody else was, because they decided not to charge for the murder, yet for this child abuse, endangerment, things like this. And I never saw anything that articulated the elements of those crimes in any documentation. Maybe you did, or any interviews. I didn't see, okay, what were the elements of the child endangerment or child abuse, child neglect? And I'm trying to cover all the possibilities here. I can't remember exactly what they recommended. I didn't see any of those elements from 28 years ago, when I remember this as just a layperson, kind of watching, so to speak, not involved in the case. I mean, up until, you know, this documentary, and then in the last few days reading about the case, I never saw any elements of those crimes, which kind of brings to the point that you made about the ethical responsibility on the part of the prosecutor, the DA, not to file a case that they believe that they cannot win. There's not evidence support. They must have felt the same way that I do, and I'm sure that you do, that there were no elements of these particular crimes. I think that the grand jury here was trying to, you know, split the baby, so to speak, pardon the, you know, poor pun, mm-hmm. That, well, there's zero evidence that, you know, we can come up with as far as the murder, but we got to go do something with these people because we, you know, we kind of believe, like the rest of the public, they probably did something wrong. That's what I think happened here, which if I'm right, I think it's despicable. But yeah. It shows that if I'm right, it shows that anybody, if you don't have some strong character, that you could be manipulated through public opinion.
And I know the theory that the lead investigator had, there was one media appearance where actually the family, John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey, squared off with the lead investigator on Larry King. And, you know, he had this, he, as I said, he had this theory about bedwetting, and that the And that Patsy, in a fit of rage, I guess, struck JonBenet's head on the edge of the tub, or slammed her head on the edge of the tub. And there was not any forensic evidence to substantiate any of that.
No.
Not a bit. And it's like, at what point do you have to follow the evidence and let go of this kind of manufactured theory that you have in your head of how the crime goes? Because there was really, that I saw anyway, really no evidence whatsoever to support this theory that the lead investigator had.
Yeah. You know, I said a long time ago, Bill, in one of our shows, there are times in my career where I really believed that maybe a crime occurred. I really believed that a particular person committed the offense, but there was simply no evidence, or there wasn't enough evidence to substantiate what I felt happened. So in my investigation, I would write down my recommendations to the city attorney or the DA about why I'm not recommending prosecution, because I can't provide you enough evidence. And it's not easy. It's not easy. You go to bed thinking, man, I know that guy did it, but I can't say, well, I recommend you prosecute this person because I believe they did it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work like that. That's a very tough place to be in, but you have to do what the law says to do, what your training says to do. And I don't think that happened here.
So the case kind of goes cold after that. I mean, a little bit. Lou Smith keeps working on the case initially. In his mind, it was some type of pedophile who he thought likely attended the pageants or was somehow involved in that scene, that pageant scene. A couple with the last name Singular started working on a book about the unintended consequences of some of these pageants. In other words, are they almost like a venue where people can go to victimize children or seek out victims, if you know what I mean by that?
Yes.
So a couple people have come up over the years, and I'll just touch on a couple of them and then wrap up how I think this case could be solved today. A photographer, Randy Simons, and I bring this up for an interesting reason, right? So after JonBenet's killed, this photographer who took like pageant pictures or glamour shots of many of the children that were involved in this, he starts calling other parents and kind of blurting out or unsolicited statements saying that he didn't kill JonBenet, which is a little bit weird, Mark, right? And at one point he's arrested walking down the street naked, and police confront him, and one of the first things he says is, I did not kill JonBenet. So he also had a charge for pedophilia in Oregon. I don't know how that was adjudicated. His name was Randy Simons. So he looks decent as a suspect, right? He's around kids. He's the photographer. He has a history. He's kind of saying he didn't do it for no reason. No one accused him at that point of doing it. They get DNA from him. What happens? It's not a match. But here's why I bring this up, Mark. He's excluded. Now, I want that to sink in. He's excluded because his DNA was not a match. Patsy Ramsey, John Ramsey were not excluded when their DNA wasn't a match. And they were kept under the investigative microscope as the primary suspects for years.
Yep.
So that is a little bit troubling. If you're going to rely on the DNA to exclude someone, then you're relying on science. You're doing a science-based investigation. You can't say, except we know that the parents did it, even though their DNA didn't match this DNA in the underwear and under the fingernails. And from what I saw, Mark, the cops went so far as to contact the factory in China where the clothing was made, the underwear was made. And they could tell from the DNA, I think, that it was a Caucasian male.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. And they asked this factory, do you have any Caucasian males who work there? We want to sample their DNA to see if perhaps their DNA got in this underwear in the manufacturing process. And that would help us in this investigation because we could then say it's not valuable evidence. So they're almost trying to discredit their own DNA evidence on the one hand because it doesn't match their narrative that the parents did it. But on the other hand, they're using that evidence to exclude someone who has a prior conviction, had access to kids, and was making these really weird statements to make it clear to people that he didn't do it. Can you do that? Can you play it both ways?
Not if you actually want to be considered a real investigator. The answer is no. Of course not.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, there was another guy who was an English teacher in Thailand. He had been hit with charges in Northern California, I think, for some kind of child sexual abuse, fled the country, was in Thailand. And again, he actually confessed to it, knew some details of the crime as well, but again, excluded because he wasn't a DNA match. And in his case, now this goes to eyewitness testimony being not necessarily reliable. And I mean, you and I know that to be the case. I think some people not involved in law enforcement would be shocked by that. They'd say, man, eyewitness testimony is the best. But a housekeeper for the Ramseys or a house caretaker, they had a house in Michigan at a lake maybe, or I don't know, maybe I'm manufacturing that part, but they had a house in Michigan, like a vacation house. And their caretaker said that they had seen this guy in the garage of their house up in Michigan. This guy, Mark Carr, or John Mark, let me see. Yeah, John Mark Carr. So there's a guy that was supposedly seen at a house in Michigan that they owned, confessed to committing the crime, lived in Atlanta, kind of near where the Ramseys lived at one time in Atlanta, so et cetera, et cetera. And again, he's excluded. Why? The DNA doesn't match. So the DNA evidence, super significant in this case, Mark. They've talked now about resampling the DNA. And let's talk real quick about familial DNA or forensic genealogy. I got to think, Mark, and we talked about this in length when we talked about the Golden State Killer, how that case was solved. If they resample the DNA in this case and they're able to do that, you know, it's what did I say? Almost 30 years. They create a profile, and if they can use forensic genealogy, I want to say that there would probably be about a 95% chance that they would find a relative of the individual who left this DNA. And through that, they could use traditional investigative techniques, kind of build out that family tree, look for someone who was in Boulder or in that area, and all of a sudden the case doesn't become so overwhelming and the suspect list gets a lot smaller. Then they start honing in on individual DNA samples and actually do the one-to-one test where they make a positive identification. Is my assessment wrong, Mark? Is this the type of case where that tool that we talked about before could probably solve a cold case?
Well, I certainly think it's likely. I think it's likely. And this is why I was saying earlier, Bill, about the science of DNA testing is so much more advanced now than it was 28 years ago. If we have the same capabilities then that we do now, the case very well may have already been solved. But I think you're right. We didn't have any of these sites where, you know, any of us can go on, put our DNA there and try to find out, you know, who our great, 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 great uncle was, you know, next to Stonehenge. But now it's all out there, and or, you know, a lot about us is out there now. So I think it's very likely that through the testing procedures that you articulated, I think it's very, very likely that they'll probably come up with a narrow list of possible suspects. And from there, you can do regular traditional investigation and backtrack and try to put people at the scene, try to look at their criminal backgrounds, motives, their accessibility to the house. So, you know, I am hopeful that they're going to solve this with updated DNA procedures, but only time will tell. But I'll be honest about my personal feelings. I really hope that Obviously, I hope that they do. But one of the reasons I hope they do, obviously, to put this to rest, and give John Ramsey, who I believe is completely innocent here, some closure, in the sense that someone's held accountable for his child's death. But I hope it really, really illustrates how bad an investigation that this was and how biased of an investigation that it was. I really hope that it does, because I'm hoping this will set the stage for future investigators to do their job, no matter where the evidence takes them. And even if it doesn't take them any place to a conclusion, that you rely on the evidence purely and not your subjective, perspective here. By the way, let's not forget that her older brother, Burke, was also brought into this, as a possible suspect, through the media, through leaks, things like this, yeah. Who sued and won a lot of money for really being slandered, I think libeled, in print about his possible involvement, responsibility for his sister's death. Who's in his mid-30s now. But these things happen when people are just desperate to solve someone and be the person that, puts a period in this investigation rather than just doing their job. It just makes me so angry, because it's not good for law enforcement when you don't follow the facts.
Well said, Mark. I think that sums it up. I mean, that's a great point you brought up. There were several lawsuits filed by the family and by being John Ramsey and Burke Ramsey, the son, the ones that I'm aware of resulted in settlement in favor of the family. We don't know the details, but that's how it is. So folks, thanks for joining us to talk about this. I think the chief summed it up best. I agree with him 100%. Watch this case over the next 6 months. If it's ever going to be solved, it'll be solved then. And if there's not more DNA testing done, I almost feel like it's done just because they don't want this alternative theory to turn out to be true and kind of bring further discredit to the Boulder Police Department. Thanks, folks. We'll catch you next time on Truth Nation.